Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 679 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and I'm going to be talking about a few recent Marvel titles that were released. The first one I'm going to talk about is Wolverine The Long Night number 1. This is written by Benjamin Percy. The art is by Marcio Takara, colors by Matt Milla, and letters by Joe Caramagna. This is actually adapted from the Marvel podcast, Wolverine A Long Night, which you can go to wolverinepodcast.com to listen to. The series is available for free from your favorite podcasting app, and I guess Marvel decided it was popular enough to put into comic book form. So it's the same story. I have listened to some of the podcast, not all of it. There's so many great podcasts out there. I'm a little behind on things. But as I said, I have listened to the first few episodes. I believe it's 10 episodes altogether. So I would think that that's kind of the length of this comic book strip. It does seem to be that the first issue here kind of coincides with what happens in the first episode of the podcast. So I expect they'll be about the same. So if you plan on listening to the podcast, you may not want to listen to this recap of what happens in episode 1 if you want to go and listen to that, because I'm going to basically tell you what happens, but it is cool to listen to the podcast. It is very much one of those old time radio plays in the days before television, and by that I mean it's not like some audiobooks, let's say, where it's just one person reading the entire story doing all the voices. This is a complete cast of different voice actors. There's sound effects and mood music and all that. So it's very much kind of an audio play, so to speak, in podcast form. So it is entertaining, as I mentioned, and I would encourage you to go and check it out. Or if you prefer, pick up Wolverine The Long Night comic. As I said, it does follow the same story, which even though I haven't listened to it all, it is intriguing. There's quite a bit of mystery involved here. So it starts off, we're in Alaska. There's a fisherman who's basically explaining how there's 1,000 ways to die in Alaska. And all of a sudden you can add murder to the list. And murder's why they're talking now. Because apparently this fisherman is talking to a couple of FBI agents. And he tells them about the morning that he came upon a ship, which was apparently abandoned. They were on their way to look at some crab pots, pick up some of their crab pots to see what they had caught, when all of a sudden, as they headed past the Five Fingers, which are these tall spires of rocks with bunkers on top, they noticed that there was, a ship adrift there. And they weren't really happy when they first saw it because they didn't realize it was adrift. And he didn't understand why this other fishing boat would be in his territory. And it was a fishing boat that had the name Langrock on it, which is this big corporation in town who feel like they've sort of overfished the area. The way he puts it, they've pulled so many fish and crab out of the waters that some say the bearing's gone bald. But anyway, before they can raise any hell, they realize that there's nobody on board. And the boat is drifting. It's going to smash up upon the rocks of the Five Fingers. So they call it into the dock master, and they manage to throw a bumper over the side of their boat and position it in between the Five Fingers and this boat that looks abandoned. And they search its stern to bow. They don't find anything until the only place left to look is the hold. And when they do look in the hold, they find the crew staring back up at them, clearly dead. He says that one of them had his eyes open, mouth open, his face was split clean with red lines raked across. And as we look at it, it looks like claws, right? It looks like a Wolverine claw marks. And the FBI agent says, "Red lines, can you be more specific?" And he says, "Like I said, red lines across the face, like a fillet knife went slit, slit, slit." And so they tell him to keep going. He's like, "Well, I climbed into the hold, trying not to think about what I was doing, see if any of them were still alive, but none of them were. And then a wave came by and knocked me off my balance, and I slid down into the thick of it all." And I noticed when I stood upright that there was something below me, something crinkled at my feet. And when I looked down beneath me, underneath the bodies, there was something else, packages. And they say, what, packages? What do you mean packages? He says, like plastic bundles. I don't know, drugs probably. And the scene shifts back to the present. We're in Burns, Alaska. We meet Special Agent Sally Pierce and Special Agent Tad Marshall. And Pierce is saying, well, there's no mention of any packages in the police report. And he says, well, I don't know. I can only tell you what I saw. And Marshall says, well, you said that you called it into the dockmaster before you got on the boat, but not the Coast Guard. And he said, well, look, I talked to the Coast Guard this morning. I talked to the cops. And now I'm talking to you. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you. And Pierce says, well, the records indicate that they didn't contact you till 6 hours after you got back to the dock. Why did it take so long? He says, hey, you know what? We take care of our own in Burns, right? You bring in the Coast Guard and they're likely to bring in suits just like you. No offense. But, you know, we're not really looking for the lower 48 to tell us what to do. And Marshall says, well, if somebody dies on the water, it is a federal matter. And this fishing boat captain says, well, so what are you thinking? It's connected to the other deaths? I'm like, wait a second, what other deaths? He's like, well, I figured that's why you were here, right? Don't you know what's been going on in this town? And they said, well, you have to, you know, excuse us. We only got off the plane a few hours ago. We're still getting the lay of the land. And they ask again, what other deaths? And he says, well, the cops are saying it's grizzlies. And people might have believed it the first time, but not the second. So apparently two people have been killed by grizzly bears, supposedly, recently in this town of Burns. And the captain says, you know, this used to be a place you didn't lock your doors. And between those grizzly deaths and this boat, a lot of blood's been spilled in one place all of a sudden. And so as the agents walk away, Pierce asks Marshall, what did you see when you walked on the boat? He said, well, the cabin, the latrine, they were all torn up. And that's where he, if it is a him, must have engaged the crew. And, you know, I found plenty of bladed gouges on wood and metal, indicating some supernaturally high tensile strength of the weapon. And in the engine room, I found and bagged a cigar, and it smelled fresh, was tossed in a corner. Great place for a stowaway to have been hiding. And the lifeboat was still there, so he either had another vessel or he swam, which doesn't seem possible considering how cold the water is. Except, and Pierce says, yeah, except for who we might be dealing with, right? And they're like, yeah, except for that. But here's what I'm having trouble with. She says, the hold, right? You examined it? He's like, right, I did, and there was nothing. There was nothing to examine. They'd already scrubbed it clean, like bleached it, and as far as packages, there's no mention of packages in the Coast Guard or the police report. So is this a drug shipment gone wrong? You know, Russia's only like 50 miles away. Fishing boat could be the perfect mule. And Pierce says, well, if that's true, then the local police must be involved too, because they didn't mention anything about any drugs. And Marshall says, well, that's not really why we're here anyway, is it? She says, no, it's not, but everything's relevant and everyone is relevant if we want to find our killer. So the coroner is also the director at the funeral home. So I'm heading there now. I'm going to find out if she discovered anything during the autopsies. And you stick around the dock and keep asking questions. And as she drives away, Marshall says, you know, it's beautiful here. Do you think it's beautiful here? And Pierce is like, you know, I hadn't noticed. We're not here for sightseeing. So it seems like one of them's a little more cynical and a little more jaded when it comes to these two FBI agents. So as she drives away, Marshall tells himself, what are we here for? Seems like the answer to that might have gotten a little more complicated all of a sudden. So at the Burns funeral home, we meet the coroner, this woman who says she's a one-woman operation, and she basically gives gives her the facts. And, like, there really wasn't much left for me to examine, so I don't really know what to tell you. So Pierce says, well, do you mind if I take a look at your reports? And she says, no, not at all, but my cursory examination appears to show that these men died of blunt force trauma, either to the head or the spine or exsanguination, which basically means they bled out from, you know, a slice across the throat or whatever. And Pierce says, yeah, I noticed a pierced heart or the carotid or the brachial or femoral arteries are severed. And the coroner rather says, yeah, you're good. You notice that, and it seems like whoever did this knew where to strike, like knew the vulnerable spots on the human body. And so Pierce says, yeah, I know it's early, but any evidence that they got any hits back, you know, bruised knuckles, flesh beneath the fingernails? And the coroner says, no, it doesn't really appear so, but we've got blood samples coming soon, so they might show us something. And Pierce also says, well, I noticed there were three pistols on the boat, but only one was fired. And she says, well, again, we'll have to wait for blood samples from the boat to know if the bullet found its mark. But what's clear is whoever did this slaughtered these people. So soon at the Burns Peninsula Sheriff Department, the FBI agents are telling the chief, thanks for letting us use your office. And he said, well, I'm not letting you use my office. I apparently have to. And Pierce says, that's right. You're obligated to house us and assist us. And the sheriff, who seems none too happy, is just asking, well, how long are you going to be here? And she said, well, as soon as the bodies start stacking up. And Marshall says, yeah, 9 fishermen, 2 women. That's going to leave a pretty big hole in a small town like this, right? And the sheriff says, you know, there's no connection. That was a grizzly. It got spooked and it mauled somebody. You focus on your boat. And Marshall puts his hand on the sheriff's shoulder and says, you know, we need to try to make this work. I realize you're uncomfortable. And the sheriff's not having it. Brushes his hand off and says, look, maybe I'm stating the obvious here, but this isn't Chicago or Miami or LA. It's Burns, Alaska. And that means we deal with more missing persons, domestic abuse cases, substance abuse cases than any other state on a per capita basis. We're bigger than Texas, California, and Montana combined. Something you folks from the lower 48 seem to forget. So you're going to have a hard time getting what you want out of this place unless you play nice. And they say, well, that's what we're trying to do. You know, give us the usernames and complete access to your system and your case files on the two female victims that were attacked by the grizzly bear, supposedly. And, you know, we'll try to get our work done as fast as we can. And the sheriff somewhat reluctantly says, yeah, okay, you know, I'll do that. But I care about this town, okay? I've lived here most of my life and I want to keep it safe. So whatever did this to those boys on the boat, let's find them. And they say, yeah, sheriff, you know, we're on your team. We're not here to interfere, but but to help. So, you know, just help us out. Help us help you. And he says, okay, well, you know, I hope that's the case. And as he starts to leave, they're like, well, wait a second. There's 9 men in the morgue, and it was supposed to be a 10-man crew. So was there something missing? Like, apparently, according to the dockmaster's log, there was a Stephen Washburn that was supposed to be on the boat. And the sheriff says, oh, man, that's right. I got sidetracked. I actually was coming to tell you that he didn't show up to work that day, and now he's not answering his phone. And I'll send one of my deputies with you to take you over to his place, see if you can find out anything. So this deputy, Bobby, who has only been on the force for just a little while, like literally a few weeks, and he seems pretty naive, pretty innocent. He drives these two agents over to the house of this Stephen Washburn, giving them some information along the way about what a small town it is and how Alaska sort of doesn't fit the way that they think it might in terms of the people there. He goes on to say that his mom always called Alaska the island of misfit toys because the people that are there, they're there because they don't fit in anywhere else. And everybody wants their privacy because everybody's got something to hide. So for somebody so cynical or somebody so young and naive, it's a pretty cynical outlook on life. And he does say that mostly it's loggers and fishermen and bartenders, white, black, Asian, Mexican, and indigenous, but they all have that in common of not fitting in anywhere else. And as they're driving to this Washburn's house, they drive next to the lumber mill, which is also called Langrock Lumber. And they notice, well, wait, Langrock was the name of the fishing boat. And Bobby tells them, well, yeah, the Langrocks are the richest family in town. They own the fishing fleet, the cannery, the mill, and they pump a lot of money back into Burns. And the only reason they have a baseball diamond and a library and a new hospital is because of the Langrocks. Joseph Langrocks basically kept their town on the map, and he keeps them alive. So somewhat foreboding. You know, you gotta immediately have a feeling of being suspicious of the Lanrocks and thinking they may have something to do with the drugs or some of the bad stuff going on. So as they're driving, they hear a message over the radio. It says, "Black is the color of the void, the chasm, the infinite. The sun's reach is fleeting, but the night's reach is forever." And Bobby sort of switches the radio off, and the agents ask him what's wrong. He's like, it's just stupid cult. And the radio goes on to talk about the long night, moonless, endless. And Bobby explains that this cult, they call themselves the Aurora, like the Northern Lights. And about 5 months ago, they showed up. They bought an old warehouse outside of town. And every now and then, they send out these communication blasts that override everybody's radio. And then the scene shifts to this recording studio. It looks like it's underground, where this man goes on to say, "We're the Aurora, and we're here in Alaska because this is where the long night takes root and grows, where darkness has its greatest grip. Now we must feed it or it will consume us." And he's beseeching everybody to join them. Their lives may depend on it. So kind of creepy. And Marshall says, "Well, the long night is coming. What does that mean?" And Pierce says, "You know what? Be ready for anything. Don't worry about that right now. Washburn showed chose a hell of a day not to show up." So they bang on his door as Pierce is speculating maybe he's sick, maybe he's dead, maybe he's the reason his crew got killed. So Bobby yells for him to open the door. It's the Burns PD. And when he does open it, he looks quite disheveled. And he says, I'm Washburn. What the heck? I didn't do anything. No need for the guns. What's this about?" And so they ask if they can talk inside. And he says, "Oh, sure, I guess." And as he walks inside, we see that he sleeps on a mattress on the floor. There's drug paraphernalia and beer cans laying all around. And they ask him why he didn't show up for work. And he says, "What are you talking about, man? It's Saturday." And they're like, "No, it's Monday." And he's like, "Wait, what?" He says, "Oh, man, I've been real sick." And they tell him that they've checked with the dockmaster, and it looks like he's been sick a lot lately. And Bobby says, "You know, there's a clinic in town, a good one. They can help you." And Pierce says, "Bobby, don't talk. They want some answers from this guy." Once they inform him that his crew is dead, he actually seems pretty surprised. He said, What do you mean they're dead? Like they drowned?" And Marshall says, "I'm sorry to be the one to break the news." And Pierce adds that they had their throats clawed out and others were beaten to death. And when he hears that word clawed, that's what really gets his attention. And Washburn says, "Wait, did you say clawed? I knew something like this was going to happen. Ever since I heard about those women getting killed, I just knew it was bad times ahead." He goes over and opens the window to get some fresh air. And Pierce says, "Well, we didn't say anything about the women. We're here to talk about your crew." And Washburn says, "I'm afraid people are going to keep on dying." And Pierce says, "Well, then talk to us. Let us help you." Marshall says, "Yeah, we know about your record. There's an outstanding warrant in Idaho. And unless you want us to ship you off to Idaho, give us something. Tell us what you know." And, looking around, it's not too hard. Wouldn't be too hard to tack on possession charges. And you'd be spending the next 5 years in prison. Right, Agent Pierce? And she says, "At least." And Bobby's like, "Well, technically, because again, they don't have a warrant." And she tells him, "Quiet, Bobby." So they get Steven to start talking. And Washburn tells him a story of a few months ago. This guy showed up at the docks looking for work, which isn't unusual in Burns. And he wasn't too friendly, which also isn't unusual. And they had just had a deckhand that walked off. And so this guy just walked right on. That's how it happens there. And they needed the help, so the captain hired the guy on the spot. No questions asked. It's not like they run background checks or W-9s or anything like that. So Pierce says, "Well, did you guys ever talk?" And he said, "Nah, you didn't really talk to this guy. He wouldn't say anything. He wasn't really friendly. And, you know, when I did ask him for a light once, he just looked at me with this dead expression. So I'm pretty much just steered clear." So he worked the boat and he did his job, and you know, it's dangerous work. Crab pots can weigh 800 pounds. You need a hydraulic lift just to lift them up. And for king crab, they go maybe 1,000 feet deep. So you can imagine one of those swinging around in the middle of an ice storm, right? So one day, another one of the guys on the boat, Sammy, he baits the trap, but he gets caught up in the wiring. And with the breakers rolling around, and he's flailing in such a way that it looks like, even though he was waving at the crane operator to hold on and wait, it looked like he was motioning for the guy to drop the pot, right? Even though he was tangled up. And so down goes the pot and down goes Sammy right with it. Overboard, underwater, gone. Like a death sentence, right? And the new guy doesn't even hesitate. Craziest thing I ever seen. He immediately jumps into the water, and no more than a few seconds later, Sammy comes flying over the rail and flops onto the deck. I mean, I don't know how it's possible, but next thing we know, and this gets even weirder, here comes the new guy flying up out of the water and lands on the deck. And Sammy's screaming, "My arm, my arm." And he points to the new guy saying, "He cut my arm off with his claws, his claws, his claws." And the new guy's looking at him like, what the heck are you talking about? As Sammy continues to claim that this new guy cut his arm off with his claws. And so they try to hush him, they try to calm him down, but he won't stop yelling about the claws. And he's thrashing around and he's talking about how he won't be able to work anymore and won't be able to throw baseball anymore, saying his life is over and claws, 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 that's all he can say. And this new guy, he didn't really like that much. And he gets in Sammy's face and says, "You know, I should have cut off your head instead. And, you know, I'm from Idaho, so I've seen some scary dudes, neo-Nazis, Hells Angels, you name it. But no one gave me the creeps like this guy, this new guy on the ship did." And after he got in Sammy's face, he just charged across the deck, and that's it. He's gone. Jumped in the water, and we figured that's the last we saw of him, right? It's pretty much suicide. Freezing water, more than a mile from shore. But no, a week later, I see him at the Dirty Shame, the local bar, drinking in a corner booth, and you know, I nearly pissed myself. Left my beer half drunk and got out, because I'm telling you, man, this guy's a psycho. People getting cut to pieces, he's to blame, whatever these claws are of his. All you got to do is take one look at this guy to know he's a killer. And so Pierce wants to know, well, what was his name? And Washburn replies, "Logan. His name was Logan." So as they climb back into the sheriff's car, Bobby's talking to the agents and they're saying, "Well, Bobby, what can you tell us about Logan's landlord?" And Bobby says, "Well, she's not much of a talker. She hadn't been able to rent that cabin for years because it's so isolated and disrepair. No water, no electricity. And apparently he paid it up front, 5 months in cash." So Bobby says, "I can drive you guys over there if you want to. I'd love to hang out more. I'm treating this as a learning experience, you know. Maybe I can help you out with the case, help you process clues." And Marshall says, "Yeah, you know, why not? What do you want to know, Bobby?" And they says, "Well, I know I'm just a rookie, but I'm still having trouble with the connections between the women and the fishermen." And Pierce says, "Well, we looked up the stats on fatal bear attacks, and there's only been like a dozen in the last 100 years. And to have two in one town in such a short period, that's pretty strange math." And Bobby said, "But not impossible." And they said, "Nope, not impossible, but certainly strange." And Bobby says, "You know, the sheriff thinks you're wasting your time. The people who died on the boat, that's your business. That's a federal matter. But the people who died in town, that's us, right? It's a local matter." And they say, "Well, what do you think, Bobby?" And he says, "Me? I'm just happy to be along for the ride." And Pierce sort of presses him, saying, "Why'd you move back here?" And he said, "Well, I told you, I always wanted to be a peace officer and Burns was hiring." And Pierce calls him on that, saying, "Well, you also said everybody in Alaska has something to hide, so..." And Bobby doesn't answer the question. He says, "Yeah, I guess I did say that, right?" But he says, "Yeah, anyway, since you're so curious, there are some equivalencies between the victims, right? The strength of the blades or claws, whatever you want to call them, it seems like that was what was used on the men on the boat and easily could have been used on these women. So they were all torn to pieces. We want to find out what's going on." And so as they arrive at this isolated cabin, they see hanging from a lot of the trees around the cabin are deer that have been gutted. And we see some deer skins stretched out over some wooden frames. And they all draw their guns, all three, Bobby and Pierce and Marshall. And we get the blurb of "to be continued." So, again, it's clearly Wolverine. I mean, it's Wolverine Long Night. What these FBI agents know of Wolverine or Logan, why they're hunting him, why they're tracking him down, what he's doing in Alaska. Again, it's pretty mysterious at the beginning of the story here. What the Langrocks have to do with everything, what this cult of the Long Night, or Aurora cult, whatever you want to call them, what they're doing in Alaska, what their connection is, what's going on with the drugs. Like, again, a lot of mysteries being set up. When you listen to the podcast, you certainly get that sort of crime noir feel. It doesn't quite come across as much in the comic. Obviously, it's harder to set the mood without background music and such. But I will say that Matt Milla, the color artist, does as good a job as can be done with the color palette he chooses, which is a lot of grays and browns and greens, and certainly muted. It's not bright by any means. I like the FBI agents. They seem to be capable, especially Pierce, the female agent. She seems very on top of things and insightful, and so can't help but sort of root for her in a way, even though apparently she's hunting Logan, who, you know, traditionally has been a hero. Bobby comes across as extremely naive and young, which in a way he sort of is. And he's a bit of a plot device so that the agents can give us information, right, without it being outright exposition. He's sort of our POV character, in as much as they have to kind of explain to him what's going on. And I love the way that we get introduced to Logan in the story, through the story from this deckhand who didn't show up for work, Stephen Washburn, when he talks about, you know, the other deckhand going overboard and Wolverine immediately springing into action without hesitation to save the other guy. But you wonder, you know, you do have to wonder. I mean, I know it was all happening in a split second, but why didn't Wolverine, I mean, he cut the guy's arm off. Why didn't he just cut the rope that he was tangled in, or even cut up the crab pot? You know, I mean, he's got adamantium claws, but I guess it didn't necessarily suit the story. So again, it very much has the same feel of the podcast. I think some of the dialogue is exactly the same. I thought the art from Marcio Tocara was pretty solid. The color work from Matt Milla, like I said, is really, really well done. Tocara's art is not quite as clean as I prefer my comic art to be. It's a little rougher, but he does a great job with transitions, and his storytelling from panel to panel is pretty solid. The panels do tend to be pretty large. And I only say that because I think if he'd gone with larger panels and more panels, we could have gotten a little bit more story in the artwork, and we could have gone a little lighter on the word balloons. But again, a lot of the dialogue and such is lifted straight from the podcast, which obviously is only audio. So in that case, it's sort of... if you're lifting it directly, you're going to end up with extraneous dialogue, extraneous script, because when you're doing it in the podcast, obviously you need to be very descriptive and sort of have a lot of language to give context to what's going on. And not all that is necessarily needed in the comic, because again, you're telling things both with the dialogue and the visual. So I do feel like they could have cut out some of the dialogue. And like I said, if they'd gone with more panels, it could have cut out even more dialogue. But then again, you're not matching up as closely to the story that was being told in the audio podcast. So I guess it's probably a tough balance between the two to sort of get it right. All right, up next we have Tony Stark Iron Man number 7. This is written by Dan Slott. We have art by Valerio Schiti, colors by Edgar Delgado, and letters by Joe Caramagna. Just to remind everybody what happened last episode, Tony Stark and Stark Unlimited launched their big VR technology known as the Escape, and it didn't go exactly according to plan. Anybody who was violating the terms of service were being banned in droves. They're kind of being, I don't want to say attacked, but antagonized, I guess you'd say, by the admin program Arsenal. And when Tony hopped in to find out what was going on, he was followed by his birth mother Amanda, who was trying to find out why Tony had been avoiding her recently. But the Escape didn't like that. For some reason, Amanda was immediately attacked by Arsenal, sending both the real life bodies of Tony and his mother into shock. And we also discovered that the controller has been behind these banned players being able to hack their way back in. And the controller has infiltrated Tony's most inner circle, and he doesn't know who he can trust. So when this story starts off, they're in the Escape, and Tony's trying to get the motherboard program that runs Escape to acknowledge him. And he's saying, I'm sorry, I'm kind of busy. He's like, what do you mean you're busy? I'm Tony Stark. I'm the Escape architect. I'm admin number one, and I'm ordering you to turn off the Arsenal enforcement program. And as Tony's ordering this, the Arsenal program continues to attack him. And as Arsenal is trying to terminate Tony, he's yelling out, motherboard. He says, well, give the proper clearance. He's like, what clearance? Again, I'm Tony Stark. I wrote this program. And she says, say the magic word. He's like, what? Please? And motherboard responds, Arsenal enforcement program disengaged. And Tony's just like, what the heck is going on? I never wrote those lines of code. That shouldn't have worked. And we see Amanda there, her avatar unconscious. And as Tony heads over to see if she's all right, she starts de-rezzing. She starts logging out. And Tony says, she de-rezzed. Does that mean she's logged out? Command center, copy. Is she back up there? And nobody responds. So Tony says, enough of this. Stark admin is ending the session. And he takes off the Escape mask, which is the way the players or the users log in. And now that he's back in the real world, he sees that his mother's unconscious. And his team lets him know that she's been unresponsive. And Jocasta is saying, Amanda, if you can wake up, if you can hear us, wake up. And when she does wake up, she's in some place that she doesn't know, wondering, where am I? How did I get here? And we see a bunch of small golden robots saying there's a new player on the field. And they're pretty snarky. You know, she's trying to get answers about where she is. And they're saying, she shoots, she misses, because she's guessing, am I dead? And, or, like, why would heaven have little gold robots? And the robots respond that she's not ready for this. Now, Amanda knows that she's still in the Escape because she's still in her online avatar, which is basically just a younger version of herself. And she doesn't recognize any of this, but she does notice there's a picture of Tony as a boy. And she's wondering if Tony sent her there. And as she's standing there wondering, all of a sudden the door opens and all the robots say, Daddy's home. And in walks the avatar of the Arsenal program. And he says, target acquired. And Amanda drops the photo, breaking it, saying, you're that Arsenal thing. Stay away from me. And before Arsenal can attack, he scans her and he's saying, wait, guest protocol permissions have been granted, standing down. And we see Howard Stark exit the Arsenal program, telling Amanda there's no need for her to be scared. He introduces himself as Howard Stark and says, now, who are you? How did you get access to the home setting? I think there's been a mistake. I was told that Tony's mother would be here. And then we get a computer voice saying, I understand the mix-up. And it's motherboard, and Amanda's trying to interface with motherboard, saying, this is Amanda. I need you to log me out. Motherboard tells Howard Stark that this is Amanda. She's Tony's biological mother. And though biology holds a little sway here, that's what the mix-up was. That's why Amanda is there. So then we see a flash of light, and another being materializes, and this new person is Maria Stark. And she says, biological, digital, one's as good as another in the Escape. And now that I'm here, we can talk face-to-face, mother-to-mother. And Amanda's like, oh, crap. So meanwhile, back in the real world, they're saying we really need to do something, check her vitals, and maybe we can wake her up. And so Jocasta says that her heart rate, brain activity, and breathing are returning to normal. She seems stable for now. And Tony says, okay, we're looking at two options. We leave her in there and figure out what's going on. And Jocasta says, well, taking her out might be too jarring because we're not sure what she's doing in there. I'm not running on full charge, so it's hard to think. And so they're like, well, I don't know. We're wasting time. Amanda's only one person, but what's happening to her could be happening to millions of other people around the world. Don't we need to figure that out? And so someone says, well, should we reboot the whole system? That would, you know, log everybody off. Someone else says, but what if it is just Miss Armstrong? What if it just is Amanda that's the only glitch? We just launched this. You know, we were waiting for this rollout for years. So, you know, we don't want to panic the stockholders and think of the investors. And so they all start arguing amongst themselves. Investors, what does that matter? Women and children could be dying. And, you know, there's thousands of safeguards that we put in. They should kick in any minute. And, you know, everybody's arguing. And finally, Tony says, that's it. Enough. Until we know more with what's happening, Amanda stays there. We'll wall her off in a section. And as for everybody else, and he gets onto a microphone, and I'm imagining this shows up as text for everybody else who's logged into the VR. He says, all users, we're experiencing technical difficulties. Please log off, save your progress. The Escape is closed until further notice. So a couple of his employees are like, oh man, this is going to ruin our brand. But Tony's undeterred. He says, I don't care about Stark Unlimited. Lives are in danger. And my technology does not put one more life in danger, not if I can help it. That's the rule, and that will always be the rule. So in a very short period of time, everybody's logged off, every single user on Earth, except Amanda. And as Jocasta says, yep, she's holding steady, and Stark's about to run a diagnostic. All of a sudden, he sees all kinds of people log back in to Escape, even though they had locked it down. And his staff is telling him that these are illegal entries and they're all the banned accounts. All the accounts that had previously been banned by the Arsenal software have hacked their way back in. And they're wondering how they're doing that. And a voice says they aren't, as the controller appears on the command screen. And he says, I'm doing it. And he greets them and says, you may have cleared your players from Escape, but mine are still inside and they're under my control. And unless you want to kill them and tear their minds out of the system, you're going to do exactly as I say. And Tony is not going to do that, not for one second. He says, oh no, the controller, who could have seen that coming? Oh right, that'd be me. And he opens a little lid on the desk and says, pushes a button that says, big red mess up the controller's plans button. And apparently he's known all along that the controller has been up to something. And he sends coordinates of the base. He just discovered where the controller is by pressing this button and following the controller's connection back to his home base. So he calls the Wasp. He calls Rhodey. He says, I'm sending you the coordinates to the controller's secret base. I'll meet you there. And his team is wondering how long he's known that the controller's been targeting them. And it's been all the way back since the first issue when Tony saw a control disc inside Fin Fang Foom. So Tony asked them to take his mom to the infirmary and monitor. And meanwhile, they'll take care of the controller. So Andy says, I'm coming too. And Andy is a robotics expert that Tony had just hired recently, who has some romantic interest in Tony's biological mother, Amanda Armstrong. But Tony says, no, Andy, you can't. And he tells everybody that he's leaving Andy in charge until he comes back. And Andy's like, wait, what? I'm a robotics expert. I'm not a manager or CEO. And Tony says, listen, you're the newest hire. You came on board after the controller made his first move. So that means, and Andy gets it. He's like, yeah, that means I'm the least likely to be under his control. Tony says, yep. And that means you're the one person I can afford to trust. So he tells everybody the controller's found a way to break through the Escape's defenses, and the motherboard operating system's been compromised. And as far as we know, there's only one man who can go into Escape unnoticed. And we saw that a couple of issues ago, and he's referring to Machine Man. So Jocasta's like, oh man, this is really inappropriate. Don't ask me. And Tony says, I wouldn't, but lives are at stake. And I need you to bring in your ex-boyfriend. I need you to bring Aaron in because he still may have that illegal interface and it might be our only hope. So Jocasta leaves as Tony says, I need all of us to focus on one objective, finding a way to get Amanda and everyone else that's trapped in the Eastgate out of there safely. So they say, well, we get it about your mom, but the rest of these people, they're the worst of the worst. They're jerks. They're trolls. That's why they got banned in the first place. And Tony said, well, I don't care. We're the good guys and we save everyone, even the jerks. So one last thing before he heads off to the controller's secret base, and he addresses Friday, who's another AI that he's created. It used to be the one that ran his suit, but now has her own body. And he tells her, motherboard has been doubling as my armor's operating system, my AI operating system. But since she's compromised, I can't rely on her, and it's why I need you. And that's the last thing that she wants. She hated being trapped in that armor, and she calls Tony out on that, as he says, I need you to download your AI program back into the armor. She says, no, you said I'd never have to do that again. You promised. And Andy's on her side. She's like, yeah, that's why you sent Jocasta out for Machine Man first. You knew that she'd never agree to this. She's very much an AI activist, and believes in the rights of these artificial beings. And Tony says, look, I'm sorry. There's no time to argue. Download your operating system into my suit now. And Friday says, okay, but you got to promise me you're going to let me out of that tin can after. It's so claustrophobic inside. And Andy again says, remind me what happened to us being the good guys. Tony doesn't answer. Instead, he flies off saying, come on, Friday, we're needed. And as they fly off, Tony tells her, just keep it together. This will be over before you know it. So meanwhile, at the Uncanny Valley Secret Robot Bar, we see Machine Man, Aaron, there talking to the bartender. This is some great, fun dialogue from Dan Slott. Just the way that he has these robots talk that remind us that they are artificial beings. As Machine Man's talking about missing Jocasta, he likens it to missing lines in his base code. And she's the zeros to my ones, what should I do? And the bartender says, again, this is great. He says, my advice? Take a paperclip and stick it in that tiny little hole in your heart and move on, Aaron. And anybody who knows anything about electronics will know that there's often that tiny little pinhole just big enough for a paperclip with a reset button where you can wipe clean memory or whatever. And so that's the bartender's advice, right? Reset your heart and move on. So it's pretty funny. So as he's sitting there, Jocasta does show up and say, Aaron, I need to speak with you. It's urgent. And at first his reaction is, wait, in a nanosecond you show up and I'm supposed to reboot our relationship? Really snarky. And then his tone changed. He says, well, let me tell you something, Miss Jocasta. I'm perfectly fine with that. Delete everything I just said. You and me, we can make this work. Jocasta and Aaron 2.0, right? The next version. And Jocasta's like, not be quiet, not shut up, but rather mute yourself. Oh, for Pym's sake, right? Because to these artificial beings, Hank Pym is sort of like God. That would be, oh, for God's sake, but instead it's Pym's sake. So again, just that funny, clever dialogue from Dan Slott, letting us know that these beings are very much different from us. And Jocasta says, I don't mean like that. We're not getting back together. This is about Eastgate. It's about Stark. Well, that doesn't make Machine Man feel any better. I mean, again, we saw a couple of issues ago how Machine Man sort of looks down on them. And we see it again here. He says, oh, of course it's about Stark and your organic friends, right? The meat bags, as he calls them. And Jocasta's like, oh, this subroutine again? And she explains to him, hey, this is important, more important than our petty squabbles. There's thousands of people trapped inside, and you might be the only one who can save them. Don't you still have that illegal Eastgate interface? And he says, well, it's somewhere. Why? And she says, well, you can use it to infiltrate the Eastgate and to help out. Be the Machine Man of old, the Avenger, the hero. And as she's telling him, please, all of a sudden she starts to stutter and basically collapses in his arms as she says, her power reserves are failing. Don't let me down. And then she powers down. So because it's maybe her last wish, I mean, who knows if she'll be able to be recharged. Will Machine Man do it? I guess we'll have to wait and see. So meanwhile, New Jersey and the Cranberry Township, Jen and Rhodey are approaching the secret base of the controller, with Jan remarking, okay, so this is where you put a supervillain base, New Jersey. So meanwhile, New Jersey, the Cranberry Township, we see Jan and Rhodey approaching the secret base of the controller, with Rhodey saying, so this is where you put a supervillain base. And Jan says, or maybe you have a normal base, and if you stay in New Jersey long enough, it turns you into a supervillain. And Rhodey's like, Jan? But all she wants to know is, why Bane-tronics again, right? What is it with you guys and Sunset Bane, who we've seen as a rival for Tony throughout the series so far? Jan's like, change it up already. And Rhodey's like, honestly, I'm right there with you. And I'm a little gun-shy about charging into one of Sunset's facilities after the last time. So I just wish Tony would show up and tell us what's going on. And at that moment, Tony does show up and say, Rhodey, this is the future. Not only is this a new Bane-tronics manufacturing and fulfillment center, it's one step better than Amazon. They're using advanced 3D printing technology. They can make any item in their catalog and ship it anywhere locally with drones. And as he says that, they notice that they're actually being surrounded by drones that are flying up out of the base. And Tony goes on to say, you know, I'm a little jealous. I didn't think of it myself. You can get anything you want lightning fast. And as Rhodey is scanning all these drones, he realizes that inside these boxes are handguns, blade weapons, throwing stars, grenades. It's a flying arsenal. And at that moment, the controller's face appears in the sky saying, please, Mr. Rhodes, get in the spirit of things. Think of these drones more as mystery crates or power-ups. And Tony wants to know what the controller is up to. And the controller says, well, I thought you knew my master plan. Can't you figure it out? I'm just taking what you've built to the next level. And we see these drones start dropping boxes off to all of these trolls and accounts that were banned, these people that were banned from Escape. And they're still jacked in, right? They're still wearing their mask that logs them into Escape. But they're seeing these boxes drop in Escape. Like they're walking outside their front doors and picking up real weapons without realizing it. Because what they think is that they're still in Escape. So what the controller's doing is giving away for these users to live out their fantasies, whether it's gunslingers in the Old West or fighting alien scum or charging, you know, a beach as some member of the army. They are acting and using these real weapons, but they're not realizing it. They're thinking that they're still logged into this. Well, they are still logged into this program, this virtual reality. But what they don't realize is in the real world, they're shooting these weapons, they're attacking these innocent bystanders. They can no longer tell what is real and what is not. And the controller is saying that, you know, you created this world and I've taken it to the next level. It's a way for all these users to live out their fantasies, but I've made it real. And Tony begs the controller not to do this. And the controller says, well, this is your game, Tony. Are you ready to play? And the issue ends. And on the next page, we get a preview of the cover for the next issue, which is a really incredible looking cover of Iron Man drowning in a shot glass full of whiskey. And the blurb below says, you're not really wearing a jetpack, user. It's a game. You're not really shooting someone or stealing their car. It's a game. You're not really taking that drink, Tony Stark. Demon in a digital bottle starts here. So we'll have to see what happens in the next issue. So I really enjoy the story. Love Dan Slott's gift of scripting. He makes it humorous. He makes it fun. The dialogue is quickly paced, as is the story. And it's just it reminds me of the fun of the Tony Stark comics, and the reason I fell in love with Iron Man in the first place, because it's always using gadgets and technology and classic villains like the controller here, where Tony has to use not only the technology available to him, but also his brains to sort of outwit and outthink his opponents. So the Valerio Schiti art is okay. I'm not a big fan of his work. There are times when I think it's spectacular. Like I love the way he draws the young Amanda Armstrong. Clean lines, really beautiful looking art. But then other times his art gets a little bit messy, and it's just not quite as dynamic as I would like, and the backgrounds can be pretty light at times as well. It also doesn't have, the armor doesn't have quite the, it just doesn't look as cool, you know, it doesn't have as much detail as I would like to see on it. So the color work also, I think, you know, this is a pretty traditional superhero comic. So I would like a more, I don't know, a brighter color palette, a more primary color palette. And I think Edgar Delgado uses somewhat of a more muted palette because I think it suits the art style of Valerio Chiti better. So it's another reason I think I would prefer a different artist on here. I know Mike Diodato's not with Marvel anymore, but he would have been good. I think Aaron Cutter would be really good on Iron Man, or bring somebody classic back in like Bob Layton, although he probably wouldn't really be interested in that, honestly, at this point. But a really great issue, a lot of fun. Yeah, I'm really, really enjoying the Dan Slott run on Iron Man, kind of bringing him back to his roots, so to speak. And we only have one Iron Man book right now, which is sort of interesting. I will say the one last thing about Chiti's art. At least he draws Tony Stark looking like Tony Stark. And by that, I mean there's been sort of a tendency lately to make Stark look like Robert Downey Jr. from the movies. And Chiti doesn't fall into that trap. He just draws Tony as Tony. So I do appreciate that as well. All right, up next we have the second issue of Miles Morales, Spider-Man. It's written by Saladin Ahmed. We have art by Javier Garon and colors by David Curiel with letters by Corey Petit. So this is the second issue of the latest Miles Morales Spider-Man book. The first time that Brian Michael Bendis is not steering the character. And we saw in the first issue that the second year of Miles Morales' high school experience is underway at the Brooklyn Visions Academy High School. And now that Miles has been there, he kind of knows his way around. He has friends, he has roommates, and he also gets to sort of relax at home as opposed to being worried because his parents now both know that he's Spider-Man. We know at the end of the Secret Wars event, his mother was returned to life. So that's made a big change in him as well. And so Miles is really thinking that things are going his way. And his creative writing class, he's been challenged to keep a journal. And he feels like maybe that will be his biggest challenge of the year. But maybe finding out where he stands with his friend Barbara is really a bigger challenge. But then just as he was thinking he was okay and things were looking his way, and even though he's been encouraged to keep this journal, which you have to think it's a plot device, like at some point somebody's going to discover this journal because this journal is just for him, right? Even his creative writing instructor is saying, no one's ever going to read this. It's for you to put down your innermost, most secret thoughts. And again, no one will ever see it but you. And so Miles is really taking that to heart and trying to use it as a way to sort of examine who he is and what kind of hero he wants to be. But again, the fact that he's putting all this information down, you got to think at some point some supervillain's going to get a hold of it. And then the whole situation with Barbara, will they, won't they, and that whole romantic entanglement and kind of the, you know, it's as volatile and crazy back and forth as any high school relationship is. I'm sure a lot of us remember that time and how important and, you know, life and death, a lot of those relationships, boyfriend, girlfriend, romantic entanglements seemed at the time. So it certainly harkens back to the early days of The Amazing Spider-Man when Stan Lee and Steve Ditko and then Stan Lee and John Romita Sr. were sort of exploring these ideas of Pete's love life and trying to make things work. Miles Morales Spider-Man has a lot of its roots in that same sort of era of a teenager, but obviously modernized. So we did see at the end of last issue that Miles was out on patrol looking for Barbara's cousin who had disappeared when he came across the Rhino, and Miles got knocked out by these small children that showed up with power. So that's where this issue starts off. And again, it's Miles sort of narrating through his journal. It starts off with, "Hey journal, it's me again. Update, my maybe girlfriend's 10-year-old cousin electrocuted me and then a supervillain had to babysit me until I woke up. So we do see him regaining consciousness. The Rhino is there saying, "Get up, kid. Are you okay?" So Miles is thinking, this week is not off to a great start. And he tells the Rhino, "Thanks for not squishing me while I was knocked out." And the Rhino's like, "Man, you big guys just like..." And the Rhino responds, "You think a big guy like me just lives to punch people, right? But I got no beef with you, Squirt." And so Spider-Man says, "So what is it, Rhino? What are you caught up in?" He says, "Look, I told you, I'm not caught up in anything. I'm just looking for my girl's niece." And that surprises Spider-Man. He's like, "Wait, you have a girlfriend?" And he says, "No, a wife, but not anymore." And Miles feels bad and apologizes. And Rhino says, "Look, Oksana still has family, and I try to look out for them. I can still do that for her, at least. Her niece is missing, and, you know, her mom's too messed up on dope to do anything about it. And so I'm just trying to help out." And Miles says, "Well, as long as we're sharing, you know that kid that zapped us? He's my friend's cousin." And Rhino's like, "Wait, your friend's little cousin is a supervillain?" And Miles says, "No, he doesn't even have powers. Well, at least he's not supposed to." And they both realize that something pretty weird is going on. And they're trying to figure it out. Miles says, "You know, maybe we should team up." And Rhino's like, "Wait a second. I wasn't asking for your help." And Miles says, "You don't need to ask. This is something that I'm wrapped up in too. And we got to figure it out." And it looks like they went that way when they disappeared. And Rhino says, "But that doesn't make any sense." And Spider-Man says, "None of this makes any sense, but it looks like we're at a dead end." And Rhino says, "Well, what do we do now? I'm not exactly an idea guy." And Spider-Man says, give me a minute here. Let me come up with something. I just need a little time." And then he notices that the sun's coming up, and he says, "You know, actually, I gotta go." And the Rhino says, "Oh, you're out past curfew, huh? How old are you, kid?" Miles is not about to answer that, saying, "This is none of your business." So the Rhino says, "You know what? Maybe we can work together. Let's meet here at 9 tonight, right? And we'll figure it out." So the Rhino says, "Yeah, you know what? Maybe we can work together." And Spider-Man says, "You know what? On second thought, I don't know. Aren't you a supervillain?" To which the Rhino responds, "Hey, I don't have any warrants out right now," which may or may not have to do with the fact that the mayor of New York is Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin. But anyway, Spider-Man says, "Okay, I agree. Give me your cell number." And Rhino says, "Nah, I don't do phones. Let's meet here tonight at 10. I'll do some poking around in the meantime." And Miles says, "It'd be way easier to text because..." And Rhino says, "No phones. Just be here tomorrow night. And if I'm not here, it's because I'm dead." So Miles heads to class. It's his first period creative writing. And his instructor's asking how the journal keeping's going, his young word slingers. I'm sure the word slingers there is used purposefully. Well, Miles tries to stifle a yawn, and his professor says, "Am I really that boring?" He says, no, Mr. Sumita, no disrespect. And Mr. Sumita says, "Yeah, you're not getting enough sleep. You need to take better care of yourself," which, yeah, Miles is definitely burning the candle at both ends right now. So meanwhile, he meets up with Genki at lunch, and he's like, "So where were you last night?" He's like, "Keep your voice down. I was fighting the Rhino." He's like, "Whoa, the Rhino, that's a throwback. That dude's ancient, like over 40. So what happened?" And Miles says, "You know, it's a long story, but we're actually working together. And I think some bad people have done something to Barbara's cousin, and I have to find him right after fifth period." So he goes to fifth period, and he finds out that Barbara's not there that day. And one of his classmates says that she heard that Barbara had some kind of family trouble, and she's gone back home. And so after fifth period, Miles decides he's going to skip sixth period and sneak off. And he gets caught trying to ditch out on chemistry by Mr. Dutcher, and heads that way instead, with Mr. Dutcher said, "You know, I didn't become vice principal of school by being an idiot, Mr. Morales. I know you were trying to ditch, but, and I'm sure you think you're pretty smart, but just know I've got my eye on you." So that's not exactly a good thing. It's going to make Miles, you know, it's going to make it much harder for him to be Spider-Man if he's got this adult always keeping a close eye on him. It's going to make it much harder for him to sneak away when necessary. So after school, Miles finally gets a chance to go to Barbara's and check on her. But she, even though she gives him a hug, and she's glad to see him, she does tell Miles to leave because he can't really do anything to help. Eduardo's gone missing, and the whole family's out looking for him, and she's just there kind of holding down the fort, and she just needs to be with her family now. And Miles is left feeling pretty bad, so he heads back to school, and Genki's telling him, don't you guys have a test on Friday? And Miles says, well, I'm facing a lot of tests right now. And Genki's like, whoa, that's deep. Did you write that before you came in here? And Miles says, what are you, very funny, what are you so smiley about? And he's like, well, actually, I'm about to help you out. I'm so pleased with my own sleuthing skills. And to which Miles responds, did you just say sleuthing? And so what Genki's found out is that he knows Miles mentioned Eduardo having a super suit, you know, a uniform, and he did some digging on some black market traffic for the dark web, and he found out that somebody delivered some custom kid-sized tactical uniforms, one fireproof, one elastic, one shock-resistant, and he has an address. So 20 minutes later, Miles meets up with Rhino, and they go to check out the lead. And once they get there, they see that Tombstone is there. So Rhino, against his wishes, Miles persuades him to wait outside while he uses his camouflage to go inside and scout ahead. But Tombstone, I mean, I don't know if this is one of his superpowers. It's not, as far as I know. He says, I feel like we're being watched. He gets that itch up his back like he's being watched, and he fires his gun at Spider-Man. He's able to basically dodge out of the way and start webbing up a lot of the villains, but some of Miles' strongest punches don't do anything to Tombstone. So as Tombstone begins to get the upper hand, that's where Rhino gets tired of waiting and busts in. And once they take Tombstone down, they are able to locate the kids that the uniforms were for, but none of those kids are Eduardo or Oksana's niece, the girl that Rhino's looking for. So what they do now, they're not really sure, but they got to get these kids to someplace safe, and they need to find out whoever sold these kids to Tombstone. And they can't go in guns blazing because they probably have other kids, and Spider-Man's just not sure how they're going to pull it off. Clearly, there's somebody who's kidnapping kids off the street, giving them superpowers, and then selling them as disposable weapons. So, again, Rhino and Miles aren't sure where to go from here, with Miles saying, we've got to try, but he doesn't know how they're going to pull it all off. And a voice off panel says, well, young man, you're not going to do it alone. And it's Captain America, who has showed up and apparently is going to be teaming up with Miles and Spider-Man, or Rhino rather, to figure out who's kidnapping these kids and turning them into weapons in the next issue. So I feel like the Miles Morales Spider-Man title is in good hands, with Saladin Ahmed taking over the scripting duties from Brian Michael Bendis. It still feels hopeful. We're still exploring a lot of what it means to be a teenager and, you know, young love and juggling being a superhero with being in high school and trying to get all your responsibilities done. We see the toll it's starting to take on Miles. You know, he's super tired, struggling to get his work done, trying to figure out what's going on with Barbara, trying to do what's right in terms of being Spider-Man and being a hero, you know, trying to trust the Rhino. And I think it's great that Captain America shows up. Like, I got really excited when I got to the last page and Captain America shows up, because if there's anybody who can help inspire Miles, give him some advice on what it means to be a hero, what it means to sacrifice, what it means to do your best and live up to that idea of what a hero is, it's got to be Captain America, right? He's one of the most, if not the most, inspiring characters in Marvel Comics. So really, really great job. The art by Javier Garon. You know, previously, you know, you think of Ultimate Spider-Man, which really is what this is in a lot of ways. You think of David Marquez or Sarah Pacelli, and Javier Garon's art is similar to their art in a lot of ways. It's very clean, a lot of detail, a little exaggeration in anatomy here and there, or facial expressions here or there, which really suits the character and the tone. Because as much as this is traditional classic superhero storytelling, it also stars a lot of young people. So you need that little bit of humor. You need those almost spit take reactions sometimes when it comes to the emotion on the characters. And the color work is also very suitable for the story that's being told by David Curiel. Very primary, very bright colors, which again, it suits the age of the characters that are in the book, as well as helping to give it that classic feel of a traditional Marvel superhero comic. I mean, you go back and look at those early issues of Ultimate Spider-Man that had the Mark Bagley art, another artist who is very similar to David Marquez, Sara Pacelli, Javier Garon. They're all, you know, his anatomy is a little more exaggerated, but certainly clean lines, you know, not a lot of extra detail in faces and such. But go back and look at those early issues of Ultimate Spider-Man. That Bagley art was colored very primary, very brightly, and it helped lend that classic feel to a lot of those stories. It's hard to believe that Ultimate Spider-Man was like 20 years ago now, almost. It's crazy to think about that. But again, this Javier Garon art, along with the David Curiel colors, is right in that same vein of classic Ultimate Spider-Man art. So it helps to give it the feel of that Ultimate Spider-Man legacy and story continuing. And with the recent Into the Spider-Verse movie being so kind of rightly so praised, and winning the Academy Award and everything, it's nice that we have a new Spider-Man Miles Morales title out on stands that that fans of the Ultimate or the Into the Spider-Verse movie can pick up, where they feel like they're getting it on the ground floor. So far from what we've seen in the first two issues, you don't need to know anything previously. You can pick these up. It's not continuing any threads from any previous Ultimate Spider-Man or Miles Morales series where you need to know any continuity. You can watch the Into the Spider-Verse movie, you know, and get a little bit of introduction into Miles, who he is, his parents there, and then you can go right into this series and you feel like you haven't missed anything. So kudos to Marvel for doing that. They don't always do that. DC doesn't either. You know, if you look at the recent Aquaman movie and then look at what's happening in the current Aquaman comic, they're in no way similar at all. So, all right. Up next, I have another Spider-Man title. This time it's Your Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man number one. This one comes from writer Tom Taylor. His artist is Juan Cabal, and we have colors by Nolan Woodard and letters by Travis Lanham. It's Mother of Exiles Part 1, and we get this issue is narrated by Peter Parker himself. It starts off on New York Liberty Island with Peter talking about knowing what it feels like to be scared, to be frozen in fear. And in his early days, he'd stand on top of a building and get ready to jump off, and he'd think, am I really going to do this? I've got to trust that I'm not going to just go splat on the ground because of some web fluid that I myself designed and powers I got from a spider. It's a little bit scary. But then he'd hear a scream, or he'd know he was needed. Something got his attention. And knowing that he was needed, that feeling that he could do something, that he could do good, it outweighed any fear he had for his safety. And so he'd jump right in. It's what he does. He is Peter Parker, the Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, and we get this double-page spread of him swinging through New York, and behind him we see all these buildings, and in the glass of glass and steel of these buildings, we see all these different classic images of Spider-Man, whether that be Venom from the Todd McFarlane Amazing Spider-Man run, or Mary Jane telling him he's hit the jackpot tiger. Him holding Gwen Stacy in his arms, him and Black Cat swinging through the air, the Green Goblin, J. Jonah Jameson. It's all these classic moments from the Spider-Man from history of the character. So he's in his own neighborhood, and he sees a van that is about to fall off a bridge. They're in the third month of a two-day pothole repair on the bridge. Apparently, they found some kind of pipe issue when they were fixing the pothole, and then that led to structural issues, and then, well, you get the idea. So all of a sudden, the bridge, there are multiple lanes that come down into one lane, and it's a mess of confusing and contradictory signs. You merge left, but not after 2 p.m., or if you're a Sagittarius, and that's how this van got into trouble. And so as Spider-Man swings up next to it, he sees it's a young African-American girl and her father, and the father's telling his daughter to undo her seatbelt. They're going to climb out, and Peter thinks, okay, it's a guy and a kid. If I can webline the truck to – and before he gets a chance, the truck starts to fall off the bridge. So he has no time to waste. He literally swings in through the window and tells both of them to go limp as he grabs them both, kicking out the side window with his feet. And as the van falls over and explodes onto the ground below, Spider-Man manages to rescue both father and daughter. And as they land, the girl notices the spider on Spider-Man's chest and screams out and smashes it, or tries to anyway. And the father is thanking Spider-Man and then apologizing for his daughter trying to squish the spider. And Spider-Man says, that's okay. I don't exactly have the most kid-friendly costume. It literally has a spider on it. And then the man tries to give Spider-Man a couple $100s. And he's like, whoa. Superheroes don't really accept tips. And he's like, well, wait, do they? I bet Iron Man accepts tips, because you don't get to be a billionaire by saying no to free money. But as Spider-Man thinks about rent and his new roommate, he's like, I just can't do it. And he tells the guy, I tell you what, there are three good people camping out on the corner of 3rd and Bowery. And if you want to pay me back, just give them as much as you can spare. And the father says, I will, and thanks him again. And then Spider-Man says, well, was that a moving truck? And the guy says, yeah, we're moving. We're new to the neighborhood. And I guess we still are moving, but just with less stuff. And so Spider-Man says, okay, well, that's one way to beat traffic. But I suggest next time you're better off taking the tunnel. So welcome to the neighborhood. And he swings off. So later at Peter's apartment building, he sees one of his neighbors outside, Marnie. And she says, Peter, I thought you weren't going to show. And he says, I live here, Marnie. I was always going to show. Apparently, she needs help carrying her groceries upstairs. And he does just that because she's afraid of elevators, I guess. And she goes, nah, they're locked rooms dangling from a cable. And I don't get why anyone my age would be willing to go into such obvious death traps. So as Peter walks inside, Marnie asks for a favor. And Pete says, sure, I just need to put down the favors I'm currently carrying for you. And Marnie tells him about this girl that lives across the hall. And apparently she's hiding and she's scared. And Marnie has a feeling that Peter can help her. Well, not Peter, but she says, you know Spider-Man, right? You take pictures of him. And he says, yeah, I know him a bit. And she says, okay, well, maybe you can have Spider-Man come and help her out with whatever it is that she needs help with. It's apartment number 72. And Pete says, okay, she's scared and hiding, and you think a total stranger knocking on her door will help? Marnie says, I do. Here, take apples. And she gives him a bag of apples. And as she walks away, she tells Pete, and you're not a stranger, you're a neighbor. So Pete goes and knocks on the door, says, I have apples, I'm your neighbor from down the hall. And this girl says, her name is Liliana. She says, you're Peter? He says, yes. He's like, oh, Marnie said you know a superhero. And he says, yeah, I kind of know Spider-Man. And she says, oh, I don't think he can help me. Which doesn't do a lot for Peter's self-esteem when Liliana continues, does he know better heroes? And Pete thinks critical hit right through my ego. He says, listen, whatever's happening, can't you go to the police? And she says, no, there's a man. He's connected to a powerful family, and he hurts everyone. He's cruel. And Pete says, well, I was just about to go get some lunch. You want to join me? She says, no, I'm sorry. I can't leave my apartment. And Pete says, okay, listen, I'll go get lunch. I'll bring it back, and we'll talk about other better superheroes Spider-Man might know. So Marnie thanks him, takes the apples, and says that's very kind. So Pete heads out, and out on the street, he runs into those three people that he mentioned to the father of the little girl, the one that was in the van, Jose, Grace, and Miguel, you know, the vets that have been having some trouble and are basically living out on the street. And they mentioned that they had some good fortune that day. Somebody gave him a bunch of money, and so they say, we want to buy you lunch. And Pete's like, nah, it's okay, you enjoy it. But Gracie's not having it. She says, listen, you walk past us every day and you always help. You've given us something every day without any judgment, and we got lucky today and we're buying you lunch. They're not taking no for an answer. And Pete says, okay, where are we dining? And it's they're just going to a little hot dog stand right across the street. As Jose says, only the best. You get the pick of the cart, my man. So Pete goes over to the cart and says, Gary, give me whichever one you'd still eat. And Gary, the proprietor, says, maybe I'll make a fresh batch. So as Pete stands on the corner eating hot dogs with his friends, he's thinking, this is, you know, it's not life-changing, this amount of cash they got for anyone, but it's today-changing, and that's something. And that's really what this book is all about. This title is all about your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. It's what Tom Taylor is trying to capture, the feel of a neighborhood. He's really dialing it in. I mean, Spider-Man, for all of his abilities, has sometimes been at the center of really cosmic universe and galaxy spanning stories in the Marvel Universe. It's kind of weird. He's sort of a street level character, but at various times, depending on the writers, he's definitely been a part of things that are much bigger than him. Certainly when he had the Captain Universe power at various times. And as I said, through various writers have made him seem a little more powerful. Secret Wars 2, he was a big part of because of his, not his level of power, but his sense of responsibility and how that inspired the Beyonder. So he really does sort of bridge that gap between the really highly powered, cosmic, impactful heroes and events of the Marvel Universe. But you also can tell street level stories with him, with Punisher and Daredevil and Iron Fist and Power Man and the Daughters of the Dragon. That's who I'm trying to think of. So he's interesting that you can, he's a character, kind of an everyman who sort of fits in just about everywhere in the Marvel Universe. But the story and the title that Tom Taylor are focusing on here is really, let's shrink that scope down, right? Let's not talk about the entire Marvel Universe, stories that involve cosmic level stuff and universe spanning stuff, or even earth spanning, or even, you know, throughout the country or the whole city of New York. Let's really dial the focus down to the people that Pete knows most, the people that Spider-Man can help the most, because they're in his neighborhood. They're his friends, his neighbors, the people he interacts and sees on a daily basis. So I love the feel of that neighborhood sort of Spider-Man story. They're part of Pete's family, right? He can feel like he's one of them, and feel like he's one of them as Spider-Man, and he watches out for them. And they, in turn, know that Spider-Man has their back, know that he spends a lot of time in that neighborhood, and they can kind of look up to him and can focus on a lot of those relationships. And it's never so evident as with this little scene of Pete and these vets who are struggling a little bit, you know, with finances and such. It's very self-evident in this little scene that plays out over five panels of them all sharing a hot dog. So as Pete heads back to his apartment building, he notices there's a couple of like Rolls Royces outside, and he's like, okay, something's wrong. And He immediately runs upstairs to Liliana's apartment. The door has been knocked down. When he goes inside, he sees that Liliana's there, surrounded by a bunch of goons in suits and fedoras. And all he thinks is, I just need to get her out of the room and worry about the next little bit. So as these guys ask Liliana, who's this? Pete says, hot dog delivery. And they're like, well, why does she know your name? Pete says, general courtesy. And his spider sense starts going off. And he says, yeah, I know a punch is coming. And he thinks, I just got to roll with the hit. He doesn't want to break this guy's fist. It would be pretty hard to explain, but obviously he doesn't think it's going to be much, right? It's just a guy punching Spider-Man. And then all we see is black. Next we know Peter's being awakened by Marnie and another one of the neighbors. And they're saying, Pete, are you okay, man? And he's like, wait, what's happening? Ow. And they notice a giant hole in Marnie's wall, or Liliana's wall, rather. And Marnie's asking what happened. Pete's like, I don't know. How long was I out? And they said, well, we found you about half an hour ago, and we called the police as soon as we got here. And Pete thinks, well, they're not coming. Whoever this was that came and took Liliana is connected. As she said, they should have been here by now. And it wasn't just her. The whole apartment is trash, so obviously they were looking for something. And Pete asks if Randy, the other neighbor, can stay with Marnie in case the cops come. And Pete needs to go to his apartment and lie down. He says, I feel like I've been hit by a train. And it's not hyperbole. He's speaking from experience because he's been hit by an unhealthy amount of trains in his time. And he's just trying to get his bearings. And he definitely wasn't expecting some random goon to punch as hard as the Hulk. And so he heads to his apartment, but he slows down right outside the door because he's thinking, I forgot what's on the other side of this door. Maya and Randy's apartment has been invaded. It's not just Randy and Pete living there. They have Fred there as well. Roommate, who's also a small-time supervillain called Boomerang, which if you've been reading Amazing Spider-Man, you know about the hijinks and craziness. And Boomerang is just, man, he's not up on his social skills, so to speak. And Pete even thinks here, he's one of the least considerate people I've ever met. And, you know, I mean, I've met Thanos. Even Thanos wouldn't sit in his underwear on my couch. And Pete's thinking, ugh, and everything's not even contained in his underwear and it's touching my couch. And as Pete walks in, Fred stands up and says, oh, hey, Pete, I didn't hear you come in. And Pete's thinking, oh, my God, he's not even in his underwear. He's in my underwear. And Pete wants to know, why are you in my underpants? And Fred says, well, it's January and it's one of my wash months, so I wash all my underwear after the third rotation. But Pete, seriously, are these things custom or something? Because I got to tell you, I've never moved so freely in anything. And Pete says, you can keep them. And Fred says, seriously? He says, yeah, because I'd just have to set them on fire anyway. And he goes in his room and closes the door and thinks, okay, I got to get out of here. I need to ask around the block and find out if anyone saw anything. And as he's about to change, there's a knock on the door. And Fred says, by the way, a woman from down the hall came and she said to tell you not to worry about lunch. She left her laundry for you in your room. And Pete's like, what? She did? Why did Liliana leave me her laundry? And Fred says, yeah, she said her machine was broken and you said you'd do it. Pete's like, okay. And as he's thinking, why would she leave me her laundry? And he's reaching for the basket. He says, wait, did the clothes just move? And as he opens up the laundry basket, there's two kids inside, two orange skin kids. And Pete's like, oh, man. And then offers them some apples. And we get the to be continued. So who Liliana is? Obviously, we don't know who these orange skin kids are. Again, we're clearly not sure, but we do know that Pete knows what it's like to be scared, and he's going to do whatever he can to try to get to the bottom of this mystery. So, again, I love the scope of what Tom Taylor is trying to do here in terms of making it feel like a very intimate story about Peter Parker, the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, We're going to get to know his friends and his neighbors really, really well. And we get that sense and that feel of family. But not only that, Taylor does a really good job of balancing all of that with a story that feels classic in terms of Spider-Man helping out somebody in need and a little bit of mystery. Obviously, it has to do with people and children of another race, whether they're from another dimension or another planet, we don't know. But it does have that, even though we're keeping it grounded, and it's a story about Spider-Man and his neighbors, and we have that intimate feel, it also has that classic Spider-Man feel of the components that make up a great classic Marvel story, people from another planet or another dimension or what have you, some mystery with who the bad guys are, all that's to be revealed. So the other thing that we have in this issue is a backup story, and it's narrated by a letter that Aunt May is writing as Pete and Mary Jane go for a swing and have a little bit of a picnic lunch on top of a skyscraper. We see that Pete shows up at Aunt May's house just as she's heading out and doesn't want to tell him where she's going. And this letter has been written later because she does apologize for being evasive because she didn't want to tell him where he was going because she didn't want him to worry. And as much as Pete loves his Aunt May and wants to trust her, and he knows it's totally an invasion of privacy, he's concerned. He wants to know what's going on. And as he's following his aunt, he comes across a kid being bullied by three others. And so he intervenes and tells the three bullies to watch out, not to bully the other kid, because he's got his eye on him. So the consequence of this is that he loses Aunt May. He doesn't follow her. Instead, he steps on the bus to remind the kids it's not okay to bully other kids. And meanwhile, we see Aunt May show up at the McCarthy Medical Institute, where the Kingpin happens to be announcing more funding for the hospital. And as they see Aunt May start to walk in to the hospital, one of the PR people pulls her aside saying, "Hey, we just gathered some people together for a quick shot with Mayor Fisk. Would you like to?" And she says, "Mr. Fisk is a criminal and a thug, and I have no time for either." And Fisk turns to her and says, "Excuse me?" And, you know, Aunt May, in the original Spider-Man, she used to be kind of frail and a little bit of a wallflower, so to speak. I guess she had that in common with Peter, you know, a bit of a shrinking violet, a little shy. But I love this newer version of this more modern version of Aunt May who doesn't pull any punches. And, as I said, Fisk turns to her and says, "Excuse me," she says, "I have larger things to deal with today than you," and walks inside. So as she gets inside, she meets with one of the doctors, just as her phone rings, and it's Peter, and she chooses not to answer. And the doctor says, "Thank you for coming in on such short notice." She's waiting on the results of her test, and we see behind her that she's sitting in the waiting room of the Maria Wheelock Cancer Center. So she closes her letter to Peter by saying, "Don't be angry. I just didn't want you to worry. A few weeks ago, I found a lump." And we see her actually crumple the letter that she was writing Peter up. So apparently he's not going to give it to her after all. But a big shock and very, you know, poignant. We've seen Aunt May die before. I hope we don't see her die again. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about this story, because again, I feel like it has been done. I mean, I guess it does go back to talking about, you know, classic Spider-Man. Aunt May's another thing he has to worry about, another thing that he has to deal with in a lot of those old stories, her being sick, her being frail. And I was just talking about how she's been much more self-confident than this modern version of Aunt May, who doesn't kind of stands up for herself more than she used to. She doesn't need as much from Peter, but maybe that's being changed around a little bit. So I hope she comes out of this okay. I mean, death has come to mean less and less in comic books these days, but Aunt May's a character that needs to sort of stick around. And again, I get it if you need to put her through a little bit and so we can see how that affects Peter, and we can tell story and have character drama through that. But yeah, I think maybe we could have done it in a different way than making her sick with cancer. But I guess we'll see. I mean, we haven't gotten the results yet. We don't know. But I hope she doesn't keep it from Pete for too long, because that's the kind of thing that kind of starts to drag after a while and gets annoying. And again, it's just something that's been done before, where Aunt May's been in trouble with this or that, and Pete ends up discovering it on accident and feels responsible and tries to find a way to fix it, whether that be some illness or her house about to be taken away because she can't pay the property taxes or whatever it might be. I mean, all those stories have been done to death, and they're really the same story in the end, right? Aunt May has something wrong. If she only went to Pete and asked for help right at the beginning, when he could really help her out, as opposed to waiting until it's too late, and then he's really under the gun to try to fix things. So again, we just want something new and fresh, because for as classic as the first story in this title feels, it's really a good classic Spider-Man story that also feels refreshing. So, all right, just a couple of Daredevil titles left here. We have the second issue of Man Without Fear, number 2. This is from writer Jed McKay. We have art in issue 2 of Man Without Fear from artist Stefano Landini. Andris Mosa handles the colors, and we have Clayton Cowles on letters. We saw in the first issue was basically Foggy Nelson coming to visit Matt Murdock, and Matt was running through his own mind as he was deep in this coma, and we basically were going back through time as the different layers, skins, and costumes of Daredevil over the years were being peeled back to sort of get at the heart of who Daredevil is. Again, I'm still not 100% sure why we needed this Man Without Fear weekly title to bridge the gap between Charles Soule and Chip Zdarsky's run, but maybe it'll make more sense once we get to the end. So the issue starts off with Kirsten McDuffie visiting Matt in his hospital room. Apparently he's awake and out of his coma now. There's no dialogue on this first page, but we do see them apparently sharing some intimate moments. And as she leaves, we see that Sam Chung, Blindspot, has been waiting outside to talk to Matt. So once he enters Matt's room, Matt thanks him for waiting, and Blindspot says, "Who was that? And also, can we speak freely?" So Matt uses his radar sense to find out that they're in the clear. There's nobody listening around them. And then he tells Sam that was Kirsten McDuffie. And, we know that Blindspot was Daredevil's former partner and knows about how Daredevil basically left Kirsten without explanation, or Matt Murdock, I suppose, left her without explanation, because she doesn't know that Matt and Daredevil no longer knows that Matt and Daredevil were one and the same. Matt says, "No, that's just her voice. She actually said some very nice things. She wasn't mad." And we get some narration here, some dialogue boxes from somebody who narrates the issue. And it's not clear at first who exactly it is, but they say, "The bravest man in the world, and at the same time the most vulnerable, and that's what I loved about him." And it seems like it's somebody who's, despite Matt using his radar sense to check and make sure they're not being overheard, it seems like whoever this is in these dialogue boxes, who's ever speaking, is somebody who's watching these events play out. So Sam says, "Yeah, I remember her from the papers. You and her were out west, right?" Matt says, "Yeah, and after, before I came back east." And the voice that's narrating says, "That's what we all loved about him, right? That he was the bravest man in the world and the most vulnerable." So Matt says, "She's part of what I wanted you to talk about. What I wanted to talk to you about, Daredevil's dead." And Sam says, "Oh, I get it, right? Like, you pretend you're dead, let Fisk and his cronies get overconfident, and then you rest up, you get healed, and then bam, we go after him. We hit him when you're back. That's nice. Because, you know, I was thinking maybe I should be Daredevil while you're recovering. I could cover for you. But then you're right, that'd be weird." And Matt interrupts him, saying, "No." He goes, no, I get it." Sam says, I get it. That's what I'm saying. I don't want to do that." And Matt says, "No, you're not hearing me. Daredevil's dead. No more DD, no more Hornhead, just Matt Murdock." And the narrator said, "He was always so passionate, so righteous." And Sam's not understanding. He's like, "Wait, so how long are we expecting this to last?" And Matt's not having it either, saying, "Excuse me?" and the voice is telling us, Matt's always so surprised when someone doesn't see things the same way he does every time. And Sam goes on to say, you know, I know what it's like, right? To be injured, to be hurt. Muse gouged my eyes out, remember? And I gave up, but then I came back. Blind spot came back. And you've got too much skin in the game to just give up being Daredevil. You've been doing this too long. You're going to retire, wash your hands in the golden basin. And the narration, the voice that apparently is watching all this unfold says, the boy's just like him, how he used to be, right? Brash and wounded, but fearless. And in response to what Sam is saying, Matt says, you want to talk to me about skin in the game? Look at me. You think I'm ever going to jump off rooftops again, fighting ninjas, walking? He can't even walk right now. And the voice says, it would kill me to see him like this right now, the way he's injured. And Matt's telling Sam that truck that hit him, it broke him from his tip to his toes. Plus a lifetime of badly healed injuries because of being Daredevil. Matt says, I'm just a bag of blood and broken glass, right? I'm done. And you should think about being done also before you end up like this. And the voice is saying, yeah, it would kill me dead. It would kill me dead to see him like this. And Blindspot and Matt argue with the boy saying, how can you give it up? How can you forget your people? Because he's hurt. He's confused. They used to be partners, but you know, it is a complicated history, a complicated partnership. Sam having lost his eyesight because of partnering up with Daredevil, and Daredevil feeling guilty about that. And Matt's telling him that he's too young, he can't understand, he's lost everything to this life. And in the end, it comes down to one word that's thrown like a punch at Matt. And it's from Sam as he leaves. He only has one word for Matt, and he calls him a coward. So the narrator says, he'd known it would be difficult. Matt knew it would be difficult. Some of his friends would never accept that he was giving up being Daredevil. Some would be relieved that he was giving up. But this boy, he believed in Daredevil, and the boy just couldn't understand why Matt would want to give it up. But Matt, he was drowning, right? And he'd been given a lifeline. And this lifeline was in the form of Kirsten McDuffie, the only woman alive who would follow Matt anywhere, and had. And when she showed up, she said she'd come back to New York because she'd heard what he'd done, how he'd pushed this kid out of the way of getting hit by a truck, and what the injuries were that he sustained, and this had brought her back. She'd come back for him. And she didn't remember who he really was or had been. Again, I mentioned that. She doesn't know he's Daredevil anymore. But she forgave him for leaving without any explanation. And she knew, she came to New York because she knew that Matt needed her, and she still loved him. And the narrator says, yeah, she loved him like all of us did. And so as she sits there on Matt's bed, Kirsten's saying, so mayor of New York during a ninja invasion, savior of small children in traffic, you really have been busy, Matt. And he says, well, you know how I get when I'm left to my own devices. So Kirsten says, well, I need to go upstate for a few days, work stuff. And then when I come back, we're going to get you out of this bed together. And Matt says, Kirsten, and you can tell he has his doubts, but she says, it's going to be hard. Recovery, I mean, it's going to be hard as hell, but I'm going to be here for you, Matt. You don't have to do it alone. And the narrator tells us that Kirsten was right. Matt did need her, because at night when he was alone, that's when it was the worst, with Matt whispering to himself, what is pain for? Pain keeps us going. What is pain for? Pain keeps us going. And this is a throwback to that first issue when we saw him kind of facing his own subconscious, going through that, the pain, the fear. And the narrator can read the questions on Matt's face as well as anyone, the ones he can't ask anyone else. Is he going to get through this? Will he ever be like he was? Will he ever walk again? And it breaks the heart of the narrator to see Matt like this. And he does insist on one window being left open because he wants to know if she's out there, if she's coming to see him. And that seems obvious right from the start who the she is. But the narrator gives us even more clues, saying another one of our company, the ones who loved him, her, the one who is death, the one who's also been made to forget that Matt and Daredevil were one and the same and what he's capable of. And if she was there, he would hear her. Matt would hear her heartbeat that always sounded like a drum, and smell the coppery reek of blood that followed her like a perfume. But she never does come. And it's Elektra. That's who the narrator's referring to, right? The real true love of Matt's life that went so horribly wrong at the hands of Bullseye. And the narrator says that's probably for the best. because after all, she's a predator, an elemental, blood, slick, ivory fanged, and a predator has only one use for a wounded animal. So on the next page, we see that Foggy has come to visit Matt again. He's taken Matt outside in the wheelchair, and he's surprised to hear that Kirsten's back. And Matt says, yeah, she's back, and, well, she's heard about everything in the last few weeks. And Foggy's saying, well, that's huge, you know? And he says, I know, you know, she came back for me. Can you believe that? After everything I did, after the way I treated her, she's here to help me, and I guess we'll take it from there. And Foggy's like, so you quit being Daredevil, and now Kirsten comes back. Well, man, I need to buy a lottery ticket because apparently the universe has given me everything I asked for. And you said my vision board was a waste of time. And the narrator says, I loved him too. So it's another clue about who that narrator might be, the fact that she loved Foggy as well. But in her own way, not the way that he wanted her to, but when have any of us ever gotten what we wanted? So Foggy's like, I'm definitely going to ask that nurse out now, right? He's thinking everything's rolling his way. And then Matt whispers how scared he is. And the voice tells us, there it is. And Foggy's shocked as well, turning to Matt and saying, you're what? And we know that once it's spoken aloud, it becomes real. And Matt says, I don't know who I am without being Daredevil. I'm afraid, right? This man without fear is afraid. And he tells Foggy, you know, the woman I love came back even after the way I treated her. She came back because she loves me. She wants to help me. I've put down the burden of being Daredevil. And despite the shape I'm in, I should be happy. But all I can think about is how afraid I am of everything because I don't know what happens next, right? The same way that truck broke loose all my own wounds, it also did the same to all my fears. You know, I can't even hear a car horn without seeing that truck flash into my radar sense. And I'm terrified of going through the recovery and then what's going to be left of me. What do? I can't walk. I don't know if I'll ever walk again. And I used to fly. And Foggy, you know, ever the optimist, says, well, it's not going to be easy, but you have me and now you have her too. And what are you scared of? Daredevil problem's gone. That means no more Bullseye, no more Lady Bullseye, no more Stiltman, no more Lady Stiltman. And Matt says, Lady Stiltman wasn't one of mine. He says, excuse me for having some fun here, but you know what I mean. None of it's your problem anymore, right? You can be human like the rest of us. Join the human race. Of all the weirdos you face, the prospect of being normal can't scare you that much, can it? And the narrator tells us, of course it can. So it's another long night. It's another long visual with Matt lying awake in bed, trying to distract himself by the pain by casting his senses out, looking for any sign of her, the one that is death, Elektra, as he repeats that mantra, what is pain for? And he hears a voice respond, what is fear for? And Matt says, fear, I'm the man without fear. But we know that's not true. We know that's not true, and the voice says as much. We both know that's not true. And we see that skeletal version of himself in the yellow costume, his original costume, saying, I'm here. Here I am. You know me, Daredevil. It's his fear. His fear has returned. And Matt says, Daredevil's dead. You got what you wanted. And the skeletal version of him says, well, you know me. What else do you fear? All the what ifs, right? What if Elektra does come? What would she think of you as a broken man? Would she draw her blades and put you out of her misery? Would she pity you? Of course, right? She has no pity, does she? She wouldn't pity you. And Kirsten, brave, plucky Kirsten, what if she tires of a crippled blind man? What if she sees you as a burden? What if, right? It's all Matt's fears that have been shaken loose. And in the dead of the night in his hospital bed, he can't help but be affected by it as much as he tries to put on a brave face. So he tells his other self, try again. I know her better than that, and she knows me better than that. And he says, you're right. Well, of course I know that, and I know your truest fear for Kristen. How long, right? How long until someone finds out who you used to be? How long until one of the maniacs and killers find out Daredevil's now crippled blind Matt Murdock? And the same thing that's going to happen to Kirsten that's happened to all the others, and it's going to be your fault. You couldn't protect us then, and you can't protect us now. And Matt sees all of them that he's lost through the years with the voice telling us. And then he sees them, sees us, the ones he loved and who loved him, the dead, the living, the one who is death herself. And we see Bullseye stabbing Elektra. And as always, at the end, he sees me. And we find out who the narrator is as we see Matt in his, well, Daredevil, he's in his Daredevil costume, holding Karen Page in his arms as he says her name, Karen. And he tries to get out of bed, tries to get in his wheelchair, falls, as the narrator's saying, if I could tell him, if I could speak to him, if I could whisper in his ear, I'd tell him that fear is a liar. Fear is a cheat. Fear is a thief. Fear steals joy, steals love, and steals courage. And fear rigs the game and makes you think you're better off not even trying. Fear tells us it can keep us safe, and we believe it because we want to, right? Self-preservation, going back to what we read about in the first issue. And Karen would tell him to forget fear and go to her, go be with her. Tell him to live a life for us who cannot, right? That's how he can honor the ones that he's loved and lost. Live. And as Matt sits in his hospital room, in his chair facing the window, we see Kirsten walk in, and Matt turns and looks at her, but waves her away. He's doing exactly what Karen Page would not have him do, doing the exact opposite, right? He's not living. He's letting the fear win. He's turning her away and pushing her away for the same reason that he left her in San Francisco, because he wants her to be safe. So she turns and leaves in tears as Matt stares, looking out the window. And in the window, we see the superimposed face of Karen Page. And she says, I'd tell Matt that I loved him and I wanted him to love and be loved. I'd tell him all of that, but even he who can hear everything, even he can't hear me. And Matt has tears in his eyes as well for having pushed Kirsten away. And that's how the issue ends. Matt still needs to recover, still needs to make a decision. He thinks the decision's made about not being Daredevil anymore, but we know that's true. So again, I wonder about the reason for this series. I wonder about why it bridges the Charles Soule to the Chip Zdarsky run. I guess I won't necessarily know until we get to that Zdarsky run on Daredevil. Maybe it'll make more sense. But it seems like this is almost a way to, I don't want to say reset, but maybe recap. You know, if somebody wanted to jump onto Daredevil with the Zdarsky run, you could read this title and sort of understand everything that's happened to Daredevil in his past in sort of a recap way, a very broad overview type way. So it's been an okay series so far. I guess part of the reason I haven't been able to really get into it is because I don't necessarily understand the reason for it yet. So I guess we'll still have to wait and see. I do very much like the art in this second issue a lot more than I did in the first. Stefano Landini does a good job of keeping it moving. And I do feel like he could have done a better job with facial expressions and emotion. I feel like a lot of the emotion, a lot of emotional beats in the story come from the Karen Page narration as opposed to the art itself. The faces just don't have a lot of expression. They're sort of generic. But the art is serviceable. It is better than last issue. I felt like last issue's art was a little below average. This is probably average. You know, it's not great art. Doesn't convey, as I said, a lot of emotional impact, which is what you want for a story like this. But it is a step in the right direction. The colors are relatively muted, which when you're telling sort of a melancholy story like this, definitely suit the story that's being told. So I feel like Andras Masa does a good job from that perspective. All right, now on to the last issue for this episode. It's the latest issue of Charles Soule's Daredevil that we're covering on the podcast. It's Running with the Devil from writer Charles Soule. Ron Garney is the artist. Matt Milla is the colorist, and we have Clayton Cowles on letters. So we saw at the end of last issue that Matt Murdock went back to the church where he had previously met Father Jordan, and he's going to give his confession. And he starts off by telling Father Jordan that Matt Murdock and Daredevil are one and the same, and that he needs to finally tell the story of how he got his secret identity back. So this issue starts off with Father Jordan saying, "So you're Daredevil, and you're also Matt Murdock, and you're telling me everybody used to know that, but now they don't." And Matt says, "Correct." Father Jordan wants to know, "Well, confession's supposed to be an anonymous sort of thing. You know that, right?" And Matt says, "Yeah, I do, but I can't tell the story unless you know who I am. And that really is the story that I'm trying to tell." And Father Jordan says, "Wait, is this a confession or a story?" And Matt says, "It's both." And we get this montage piece on the next page where Matt's talking about the Wade run, the Wade Somni run. And he's basically catching Father Jordan up on his not-so-recent past. Talks about how he was living in San Francisco. His life was very different. His identity had been revealed as an attorney. And by day, he was Daredevil, or by day, he was the attorney, Matt Murdock. By night, he was the superpowered vigilante. And it was really freeing because for years, he'd been worried about people finding out who he was. And those worries had been taken away, basically, or at least it looked like they had. And then it kind of stopped working, right? He didn't worry anymore, but then other things sort of started causing problems, right? He was with this wonderful woman, Kirsten McDuffie, and she was one of the main reasons that he outed himself as Daredevil, because she understood who Matt was, both as Matt and Daredevil, and he hadn't felt like that in a long time. His best friend Foggy Nelson had just overcome cancer, so his outlook looked good, and all of a sudden the path forward didn't seem like it was quite so dark. And he felt like he really tried. He had to stop practicing law because it got too complicated now that everybody knew he was Daredevil. And at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. He even signed a book deal for his autobiography, and he got $8 million for it. So he didn't really need to work after that. And the path forward looked good. But he tells Father Jordan, "Then again, I'm blind, so what do I know about how things look?" And he remembered it all started one night when he couldn't sleep, and he was sitting up feeling the moonlight on his skin, which to Daredevil with his heightened senses felt like whispers, the faintest type whispers. And it's the reason he mostly works at night, because the sun shouts, but the moon whispers. And as he's sitting up in bed, Kirsten wakes up and asks what he's doing. Is he going out? He tells her no, everything seems calm. And she says, so what then? And Matt talks about feeling like he doesn't know what to do, something's missing. And his regular life, his life as a lawyer, always gave perspective to his life as Daredevil. He goes on to say that most heroes have something else. Stark has his companies, Natasha has S.H.I.E.L.D., Banner has his research. And the danger when you do it full-time is that you lose perspective. You go in too deep and you might never come out. And he's specifically thinking of Frank Castle, the Punisher at that time. He's like, "I had the law, but now I don't have anything." Kirsten says, "Well, maybe you can come back. Maybe people can get used to the idea of you being Daredevil and a lawyer." And Matt says, "No, it will never work, because if I try to work a case, it becomes about me being Daredevil instead of about my clients. And that's not fair to them, and it's not ethical." And so Kirsten says, "You'll find something else, right? Change is hard." And that's what he loves about Kirsten, is that she understands him so well, and she encourages him. So they fall back asleep, but then Typhoid Mary shows up, and Matt thinks about the danger that he's putting Kirsten in now that he is known to be Daredevil. All anybody has to do is basically search for his name on the internet, and it's going to kick back an address, and any one of these old villains can come and threaten him. But what's worse for Matt is they can threaten Kirsten. So although he's able to defeat Typhoid Mary and Kirsten is not hurt this time, their house is damaged and burns. And as much as they are, Matt's scared for Kirsten and worried about the future, Kirsten, ever the optimist, tells him even at that moment, "Well, you know, this place is fully insured, and with San Francisco real estate being what it is, you're probably going to make a profit." And Matt just thinks how much he loves this woman. And so they decide to go back to New York just for a little while to get some distance from what happened. But as much as he loved San Francisco, as soon as Matt stepped out of LaGuardia, he heard the cabbie speaking 30 languages and smelled the exhaust and the hot dogs and the urine and the $1,000 perfume. And he felt the vibration of 8 million people, and he was back home, right? The greatest city in the world. And unfortunately, he's famous, though. Now he's famous. He's Daredevil, and can't even go to a hotel room without the paparazzi being there and taking pictures. And so they're in their room later, and Kirsten's like, "Oof, that was rough." And Matt's like, "I'm sorry, I don't know how they figured out where we're staying." And Kirsten's like, "Well, it's not your fault, but the next time we go somewhere, maybe you could pull the 'I'm my long lost twin brother' trick." And Matt says, "Well, wouldn't they just recognize you too at this point?" And she says, "No, I'll be my twin sister as well, and they'll never figure it out." And Matt says, "Well, I like that plan. It's solid." And as Kirsten notices him staring out the window, she says, "You know what? Just go. Get out there before you have a stroke. I know you can't wait to be out there swinging around." So that's what Matt does. He's glad to be back in the city, and he wants to see how it's changed. You know, he's heard things about, not that things have fallen apart since he left, but it's, things just seem a little different, right? People seem more nervous, more afraid. So he goes to one of his old favorite spots on top of the Chrysler building where he can just sit there and listen. And it wasn't very long before he hears somebody calling out for help. As he shows up at the scene of this guy who's about to be tortured, it appears, by Tombstone and his thugs, he's able to rescue the guy and take out Tombstone and the rest of his cronies. But the guy that he was rescuing runs off before Matt can find out what happened. And again, he feels that something's different. He gives a statement to the cops, but it feels off. And they weren't nervous, right? He's been around, unfortunately, plenty of corrupt cops in his time, and it wasn't that. They just seemed skeptical, like they didn't believe the story Matt was telling them. And so he decides to follow up. He goes as Matt Murdock the next day to see the DA and offer help for the charges against Tombstone. And he's really saying, "You know, what I wanted was a taste. I wanted to feel like a lawyer again, even if it was just for a minute in a little way." But it didn't work out, because the DA is telling Matt, "You know, I appreciate the offer, but you have to understand my position here. You're just a private citizen who assaulted five people." And Matt says, "Yeah, to save a life." I said, "Yeah, where is that life? Where is that man? He fled the scene, leaving nobody to corroborate your story. And Tombstone's attorneys are saying that you attacked him unprovoked. They want us to file charges against you." And Matt's like, that's ludicrous. Put me on the stand. I'm great with juries." And the DA says, "Well, Matt, you know, there are credibility issues here." And Matt says, what do you mean? I'm an officer of the court." "Well, no, not in New York. You're not. Here you've been disbarred for ethical reasons. So you're a very famous man who's profiting off of fame in various ways. So our concern is that the people are going to think you just attacked Tombstone to get another chapter for your autobiography. Honestly, I think we have a better chance to get this done without you or Daredevil." And so Matt goes back to his favorite spot to think on top of the Chrysler building. And he's like, "Yeah, I thought about it for a while, and the logic seemed pretty clear. I became Daredevil to help people, and I became a lawyer to help people. And all of a sudden, these two things that once worked together are no longer working, because now people know that I'm both, right? When no one knew I was doing them both, then it worked. But now, ever since I went public, this new version of my life, it doesn't work. They just don't fit together. And so I've helped so many people on both sides for years, but once I was outed, that was it. Everybody in the world knew exactly who I was, but I had no idea." So the answer became clear to Daredevil, right? And he's got to find a way to put the genie back in the bottle. And so he tells Father Jordan how he went to see Doctor Strange to ask if he could put it back. And it wasn't the first time he'd gone to Strange, but I thought, well, maybe he learned some new tricks since the last time I asked. But the answer is no, he hadn't. So then he asks Silver Surfer, because every superpowered person hangs out in New York, right? And the Surfer says, "You know, I feel your pain, but no, I can't use the power cosmic in this fashion. I will not use it." And so he next tried Emma Frost. And Emma says, "You know, you're famous and you're rich and you've got it all. And why would you want that to go away? Even if I could do it, I wouldn't, because it's contrary to my most cherished beliefs." So finally, Daredevil ends up in a bar with Damon Hellstrom. And Hellstrom says, "I can't do it, but I know a guy who might be able to pull it off." And Matt knows who he's talking about. Mephisto? And Hellstrom says, "Yeah, he's done this sort of thing before." And this is obviously a reference to One More Day with Spider-Man having had his marriage with Mary Jane erased. And Matt says, "No, I'm not that desperate." So with no help from any of them, and Matt wasn't really surprised. He knows you can't uncrack the egg. So they decided to go back to San Francisco, him and Kirsten, and they were staying at Kirsten's place. And Matt wanted to rent someplace else, stay away from all the places that they had been connected to. But Kirsten, she didn't say, "No, I don't want to hide." And Matt, again, how much he loves her. And he thought everything that they'd been through in his whole life, all that pain, all the heartache, all the death, he thought maybe, you know, it was for the better. It was different, but maybe it was all right. Maybe they could find a way to make this new life work. Maybe it was finally just time. And as he's thinking this, as they're trying to settle into to Kirsten's place, there's a knock at the door. And when Matt goes to answer it, there's two purple children standing at the door. And Matt's thinking, maybe it was just time for a new life. But that's when the purple children show up. And we get the blurb. Purple Part 1 is the name of this issue, and it's to be continued next issue. And for those that don't know what Purple Children means, it's all about the Purple Man, Zebediah Kilgrave, who has the ability to control people's minds. And we'll learn more about the Purple Children next issue. So an interesting start and an interesting story. You know, ever since Charles Soule started on Daredevil and he had his identity back, this is the story that a lot of people have been asking. So how did it happen? How did Daredevil get his story back, or his identity back, rather? It's issue 17, and we're finally starting to get the story of how that happened. And it's a pretty interesting story, and it's interesting that Charles Soule chooses this way to tell it, in flashback with Matt Murdock giving his confession, his story slash confession, to the priest, Father Jordan. And also helping us to understand why Daredevil left Kirsten. Like, how did that relationship fall apart? Why did it fall apart? And why did Daredevil feel the need to get his secret identity back? And it makes a lot of sense what we see in this issue, right? We knew he couldn't be a lawyer anymore because his Daredevil identity had taken over. And he himself says it here. The cases weren't about his clients anymore. It was about the fact that their lawyer was Daredevil. And it wasn't ethical for him to be doing both when everybody knew. And a perfect example, you know, the whole Tombstone situation. There's no one to corroborate Daredevil's story. Everybody seems a little bit more on edge because from the outside looking in, here's this guy. And it's one thing to see a hero as this faceless person who's out there doing good, right? When you put a name to them and you start adding in the celebrity status, and just like the DA said, you know, he's making money off the fact that he used to be Daredevil. Matt Murdock never would have been able to sell his autobiography for $8 million if it wasn't for the fact that he's Daredevil. So why are you still out there fighting the good fight when you, from the outside looking in, people think, well, why would you still be risking your life? Why would you have $8 million. You can do whatever you want. You're a celebrity. You can just, I mean, in the today's society, being famous is enough. You can even be famous for being famous with, you know, YouTube personalities and the whole reality TV show celebrity. I mean, celebrity influencer is now a thing, like a job description. You know, I can get on YouTube and talk about my beauty products and my endorsements and whatever. And I haven't actually contributed anything to society, but I'm famous and I have money, and so I must be important and people must listen to me. It's become a thing, right? And that's what people are looking at. That's how the cops here are looking at Matt Murdock. Like, why are you still out there fighting? Why are you still out here doing your, you know, doing this thing, fighting crime when you don't really need to? The skepticism is sort of built in, which is exactly what the DA says. So I think that Charles Soule, this is a great story. It's a great explanation to get from point A in the Wade series to point B, where the Charles Soule series starts. And Charles has a unique perspective on it, being that he's a lawyer. So again, I think this is one of my favorite stories that Soule tells, and it's so masterfully done and such a great idea, such a great concept for having put the genie in the bottle. And he acknowledges in the past different things that have been done, the way secret identities have been rolled back with Mephisto and Doctor Strange and such. And so right here in the first part of the story, Soule tells us, no, it's not any of those things that you think, to sort of keep us guessing, right? Make it harder for us to guess, because all I might be thinking, oh, maybe it's going to be Doctor Strange at the end of the day. Maybe it's going to be Emma Frost or Mephisto, but it's not. So the other thing I'll mention about the issue, Ron Garney, who, again, I've said it 1,000 times when covering Charles Soule's run on Daredevil, the perfect artist for it. It's so gritty and visceral and street level. And my favorite panel in this whole issue is when Matt meets Damon Hellstrom in that bar, and they're all in shadow. Hellstrom specifically, I mean, it literally looks like his skin is black. He's so in shadow, but he's got the blazing orange hair and the pentagram glowing on his chest. And it's just, I love it. It's an amazing panel from Ron Garney. And you also have to give a lot of credit to Matt Milla for this panel and for the color palette he uses throughout the Daredevil run. It's very much a dark palette, a lot of dark reds, a lot of blacks, a lot of shadow, and helps to suit the mood of Daredevil perfectly. And then, of course, on the last page, we get the purple faces of the Purple Children, which, again, if you're not familiar with the Purple Children, be patient. We're going to learn a lot more about them over the next couple of issues. So the Charles Soule run of Daredevil, now that it's over, I'm sad that it's over, but it's great going back through, rereading these and sharing them with you guys, because it's such a classic run. I know there were some people who love the Wade Somni run, just how sort of kinetic it was. And Charles Soule run, I know it's very much a departure from that, but I think it's a classic era in its own right. And I do wish that Charles had stayed on the character for just a little bit longer. I'm not sure why the powers that be decided to go with Zdarsky. I haven't read any of the Zdarsky run yet, so I can't comment on how that is. But we will cover it at some point once we get done with the Man of Fear bridge series that goes that takes us from the Charles Soule run to the Zdarsky run. So stay tuned for that.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.